please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The U.S., the only country to have criminally indulged in the terrorist acts of using atomic weapons, as it did in this same month of August, 77 years ago, on two occasions, by targeting the unsuspecting cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to massacre hundreds of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, in addition to polluting water and agricultural resources, can never be trusted. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kay Han, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading FRC Call NPT Review Forum. Stay tuned for more. The Farcical 4-week forum at the UN headquarters in New York, called the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty NPT Review Conference, was an exercise in futility because of the lack of seriousness of the world's dangerously nuclear-armed powers from dismantling their doomsday arsenals. If reports are to be believed, a total of 13,000 nuclear warheads are stockpiled in the US, France, Britain, China, and Russia, in addition to a few hundred more possessed by India, Pakistan, and the illegal Zionist entity, which refused to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. Despite the efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Syria, and other countries, the forum totally ignored any mention of Israel, which is the main impediment to a nuclear-free West Asia. Such selective approach by the big powers who cry wolf at the mention of Iran, even though the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a fatwa against manufacture and use of weapons of mass destruction, is indicative of the hypocrisy prevailing at the NPT, as well as at the Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, which has politicized Tehran's peaceful nuclear project, in spite of the fact that its inspectors and round-the-clock cameras have time and again ruled out any deviation. Yet, in spite of its pretensions to check proliferation, the U.S. regime continues to test and manufacture even more deadly nuclear armaments, while the two West European regimes of France and Britain have not hidden their lust for these instruments of mass destruction, forcing Russia, China, and to a little extent North Korea in developing means of deterrence to prevent being sitting ducks. The U.S., the only country to have criminally indulged in the terrorist acts of using atomic weapons, as it did in this same month of August, 77 years ago, on two occasions, by targeting the unsuspecting cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to massacre hundreds of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, in addition to polluting water and agricultural resources, can never be trusted. Washington has a track record of bloody crimes against humanity, which means a nuclear catastrophe is not an abstract threat, but a real-world risk. The same can be said of the usurper regime of Israel, whose 7 decades of genocide of the Palestinians has been now, unfortunately, condoned by unelected regimes of several Arab states who have humiliatingly put their necks under the Zionist yoke. It was but natural of Iran to criticize the NPT review conference for refusing to call on the Zionist regime to join the treaty. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, in his telephone call with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently, deplored that the conference's chief, Gustavo Zelavinen, has, unlike the NPT's previous editions, refused to press the Zionist entity to become a signatory to the treaty, he said. By leaving out all criticism of the Israeli regime, Zelavinen has set all the previous achievements of the NPT review conference aside, and this is not acceptable by us at all.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's central bank says Tehran and Moscow have officially started doing business in their national currencies, adding both countries are considering de-dollarizing other parts of their economic ties. Tehran and Moscow had long been seeking to create a mechanism to replace the US dollar with their national currencies, rial and ruble, as part of a joint de-dollarization agenda, regardless of the tough economic sanctions in place against the two nations. Iran and Russia have both been subjected to tough economic sanctions by Western countries and are determined to deepen their economic cooperation, adding that there are great capacities for increasing the volume of bilateral trade. Several officials in Tehran and Moscow have repeatedly accused the United States of using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war. China is another economic and political power that has opted to move toward de-dollarization. In fact, Iran, Russia, and China have discussed the de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative for the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication global network, or SWIFT. Following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict early this year, U.S.-led Western governments imposed several rounds of financial sanctions on Moscow, including freezing its foreign exchange reserves. The thought that the U.S. may move to confiscate one's assets in case they refuse to accept what Washington dictates has caused more countries to consider diversifying their reserve assets away from U.S. dollar. Consequently, many countries have turned away from European democracies and Washington. Regardless of who wins the Ukraine war, the United States and its allies will be the strategic losers. Russia will probably build closer relations with China and other countries on the Eurasian continent, including India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf Arab countries.
We are seeing a deepening of ties unlike any other time that we've seen before. And ultimately what this means is that the relationship between Russia and China is no longer being governed by the same economic rules that had governed it prior to this year. That is that Russian rubles are being traded. They're no longer doing business in dollars. And ultimately that is hurting the United States. And it's going to change the dollar's hegemony.
In recent years, with the increased weaponization of the dollar and Washington's use of the dollar to sanction the so-called unruly countries in America's eyes, many countries in the world have awakened and begun to experiment trading in their own national currencies. Since the U.S. has been using the dollar and sanctions as a weapon to hurt other economies, its competitors have no obligation to help the U.S. maintain the dollar hegemony. The dollar's decades-long dominance has placed America in a strong position to dictate the terms of global trade and finance for the last 70 years. But this time, Russia wants to do something different, as Moscow is determined to launch a counter-offensive against Western sanctions and the dollar-centric global financial system. Following the unprecedented Western financial and economic sanctions, Moscow asked all unfriendly countries that are imposing sanctions on it to pay for their fuel purchases in Russia's rubles. The measure immediately helped stabilize the value of the ruble and significantly diffused the negative impact of Western sanctions. In addition to crude oil and natural gas, some economists have suggested Moscow extend the requirement for importers of Russia's grain, chemical fertilizers, and other products to transact in rubles instead of dollars or euros.
I think what we're witnessing now is the birth of a multipolar world order. And what that means ultimately is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s, the United States became the single hegemonic global power. And what we are seeing now is that the United States, after two decades of brutal wars in the Middle East, in North Africa, of the rampant imperialist expansion and regime change policies and nation building policies of the US regime, that now Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, South Africa, many countries are coming together and saying no more to US expansionism.
Russia and China certainly are engaged in a bid to change the U.S. rules-based order, but instead of trying to replace one hegemony, that is the dollar, with another, they are encouraging the rest of the world to assert their autonomy and independence.
Rising costs in the U.S. have pushed Americans to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. Inflation in the U.S. has shattered all previous records in March and currently is hovering around 8.5%. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, the rising cost of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. And now government officials have warned Americans that the worst is yet to come. The U.S. Federal Reserve's Chair Jerome Powell has warned of pain ahead for Americans in the battle against inflation. While pledging that the Fed will continue to act forcefully, he also warned that the U.S. job market will suffer in order to get prices down. He says the damage which will be dealt to the job market is an unfortunate cost of reducing inflation.
Well, you know, monetary policy only has an effect of 6 to 9 months of a lag. He just started raising interest rates here significantly in the last 2 months. So it won't really start to have an impact on inflation here until fourth quarter, maybe, of this year. But it won't have that much impact, I don't believe. I don't believe that it's going to be very quickly reducing inflation from its current 8.5% down to the Federal Reserve's 2% target here within the next 6 months or even within the next 18 months. I don't think they're going to get it down to that. They're going to continue raising rates because the only real solution, even if it is a limited solution, is monetary policy interest rates. They aren't going to hike taxes to slow down the economy. Government spending is just shifting from social program spending to military spending and subsidies to corporations kind of spending. So fiscal policy isn't going to do anything. Monetary policy can only have a limited effect, but the Fed is going to push that solution as high and as long as it can to shake out whatever it can shake out in terms of inflation.
According to recent surveys, Americans believe inflation tops the list of problems the country is faced with. This has led to U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings plunging heavily, leaving the Republicans criticizing him over the issue. Nevertheless, the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry. The price of gasoline in the U.S. has witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon in recent weeks for the first time ever. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, which have included draconian measures like releasing crucial gasoline emergency reserves and even begging the Saudis to increase their oil output, have so far proven to be ineffective. While Americans are suffering and getting crushed under the dire economic situation, the government headed by Biden has just pledged another $3 billion U.S. dollars in aid to Ukraine. Washington has already assisted Ukraine with more than $18 billion in military aid since the launch of the Russian special military operation. But why is it that while Biden has described combating inflation as his top domestic priority, the government can't think about its own citizens before spending money on these wars?
This is only the beginning of subsidizing Ukraine. It's like 60 to 70 billion already in just 6 months. Ukraine says it needs 7 billion a month just to keep its economy going. Treasury Secretary Yellen of the U.S. Said we're going to give you 4 billion. So the U.S. is propping up Ukraine economically and militarily and so forth. It's becoming, you know, economic satrapy of the United States. The U.S. is deeply penetrated economically in Ukraine. That's why it won't leave. And that's why, you know, it provoked this situation with this war purposely. The U.S. Really sees it's got, its 2 feet on the ground there in Ukraine. And its whole policy with regard to this war is just to continue the war in a low grade, well, maybe not so even low grade, for as long as necessary.
All in all, the U.S. is reeling from its support of Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, while its economy is seeing a severe downfall. But this is only the latest in a catalog of problems, from increasing social divisions and political paralysis to an inability to recover from the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. And all this has led many to believe the U.S. is losing its power and standing in the world. The Palestinian Authority has renewed its push for full membership at the United Nations amid long-time acts of obstructionism and opposition by the United States. Any application for full membership at the UN would need approval from the Security Council, and that means the U.S. participation. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN says he has been consulting with Security Council members over a possible full membership bid over the past weeks. But the U.S., a full-fledged supporter of the occupying Israeli regime and a UNSC member with a veto power, on the other hand, has once again reiterated its opposition to the move, saying it will block it. The U.S.'s reason behind rejection of the Palestinians' push for membership: it should only occur after the resolution of an agreement for a two-state solution. But the real reason behind the U.S.'s opposition to Palestine's move is that membership would mean full international recognition of Palestine as an independent country on the international stage. In other words, Palestinian statehood, and that would be consequential for Israel. Yet the U.S. is at much fault for Palestinian situation, as is Israel. PA's ambassador to the UN has said, given that the peace process has been frozen for 8 years and that there is no initiative on the table, the issue of full UN membership should move forward.
Well, the United States provides $3.8 billion of military aid to the Israeli occupation every year on an annual basis. So what this means is that the United States is a full partner in all of the war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetrated by the Israeli regime. And this has been the case for decades upon decades. I mean, throughout the nearly 75 years of Nakba against the Palestinian people, the United States and other imperialist powers like Britain and France and Germany have been full partners with the occupation and these crimes against the Palestinian people. I mean, Palestinians have the right not only to full representation and recognition at the United Nations, but more importantly and fundamentally for the liberation of all of Palestine. And, you know, really what we need to be talking about is kicking Israel, kicking the Zionist regime out of the United Nations, not just recognizing Palestine.
In 2012, Palestine was granted non-member status, but this was done in the General Assembly, where no member has veto power. And now this has raised the assumption that Palestine may be following the same path to gain full membership. The Palestinian Authority's push comes just several weeks ahead of the UN General Assembly, where world leaders are set to convene in New York for their annual summit. Israel says any vote for the Palestinian cause and against its illegal actions impedes negotiations and progress in a chance for better lives for Israelis and Palestinians. The regime claims that a vote against it would obstruct peace, but these claims come in contrast to what is happening on the ground. Just looking at the past few weeks, Israel has ramped up its attacks on Palestinian towns and cities, leaving dozens dead and many others injured. Palestine, on the other hand, has been adamant that its full membership was essential if there was to be any chance of leading a dormant peace process. But why is Israel so persistent against Palestine gaining full UN membership?
Well, what we've been seeing throughout the years is that in the United Nations, the United States has consistently used its veto power in the Security Council in order to prevent the Israeli regime from being held accountable for its crimes, just as it has used that same power in the Security Council to attempt to impose its will upon other countries and to protect its own war crimes and crimes against humanity from being held up to any meaningful form of accountability. And so, of course, the Israeli occupation wants to completely erase Palestinian identity and existence, and that's been the case for the past 75 years. But what's, you know, really important is actually to fight back against and boycott and isolate, including in the United Nations, the occupation regime. Because simply saying that, Palestine is recognized in the United Nations is not doing enough to actually liberate Palestinians from the grasp of colonialism, occupation, and apartheid.
The last round of Israeli-Palestinian talks collapsed in 2014. Among the major sticking points in those negotiations was Israel's continued settlement expansion activities in the occupied lands. Iran's proposal for the issue of Palestine told a mass referendum, something Iran's leader has said would be a logical solution to the conflict.
It has been a rocky economic road that the Brits are traveling on, which continues to chip away at their income. Some were questioning how they would manage their expenses in the UK these days. Why, with an unprecedented inflation and a cost of living crisis, now their nightmare has gotten worse. An 80% increase in electric and gas bills have been announced, one that is coming before the winter season.
It is a major problem because what is happening, of course, is first of all, real incomes are falling because people are not getting wage settlements in line with inflation, but below inflation. Then tax burden has increased, you know, to record levels as well. The government has been raising taxes to pay for the furlough scheme and all the money that they splurged.
To be exact, an 80% increase would mean that it would average about £3,600, or about $4,200 per year from October. And this is terrible news, especially for the poor and the ones at the bottom half of the social strata. The UK was suffering already from high energy prices, in particular heating bills, even before the Ukraine crisis began. So bad was the situation that fuel poverty, as it was called, was leading to deaths for people who could not afford to heat their homes. These are the stats that are truly shocking, that one would not expect from a European country. For example, this article in 2020 pointed out to how thousands of people in the UK died from the cold, and that fuel poverty was to blame. On average, there were 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. Many perished because of the refusal of a society with abundant wealth and resources to provide for its most vulnerable citizens. An average of 9,700 deaths each year were believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
We know we need to do more because actually the most vulnerable households have no cushion, have nothing available to them. So what I'm looking at is how I can target that help for those people, not just to January.
The unprecedented hike for energy prices in the UK will surely affect the UK's economy. One obvious outcome of this price increase is that it will chip away at people's spending power and income. This is while people's income has not kept pace with the inflation rate. Increases have been minimal or not at all. This may explain why there have been so many strikes and protests recently in different sectors in the UK. The latest, the postal worker strike. 115,000 workers across 1,500 locations. Criminal barristers and mass rail strikes have also plagued the UK, as the country is battling a historic cost of living crisis. The outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson has sure left an economic mess for the next administration to deal with. But was it all his fault? The UK did not have a sound economy even before the pandemic started. Among the group of G7 economies, the UK has suffered the highest inflation rate than any other G7 country, as price rises have reached a 40-year record, with inflation recorded at 10.1% in the year for the month of July. That is the highest since the year 1982. And with the Ukraine crisis showing no signs of ending, the future looks bleak for the country, especially since the new administration will not officially begin work until October. And Boris Johnson's view on this, the new administration will clearly have to help people with energy bills.
That I know that even if things can sometimes seem dark now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Palestine advocates should demand an end to the complicity of sports institutions in the ongoing disposition of the Palestinian people, says Jonathan Adler, author, in an article published under the heading, Tour de France, a new arena for Israeli regime normalization? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. While U.S. President Joe Biden traveled to the occupied Palestinian territories and Saudi Arabia in July to advance normalization between the two regimes, another event was simultaneously promoting the Zionist regime on the global stage. The 2022 Tour de France, held last month, might have been the most watched edition of the race in more than a decade, with 41.5 million viewers on French public television alone. Throughout the race's 21 stages, the eight-member Israel Premier Tech team put on an unexpectedly strong performance in jerseys that displayed the apartheid regime's name and flag colors. Australian rider Simon Clark took the team's first win on stage 5, while Canadian rider Hugo Hull earned widespread adulation after winning stage 16. And four-time Tour de France champion Chris Froome, who joined Israel Premier Tech in 2021, recovered from a years-long injury to take third place on the Alpes climb. The Israel Premier Tech team was founded in 2014 when the Zionist businessman Ron Baron and former professional cyclist Ron Margalot launched the Zionist Regime Cycling Academy. Sylvain Adams, a Canadian-born billionaire and amateur cyclist, soon became co-owner of the team, and the Canadian industrial manufacturing firm Premier Tech joined as a title sponsor at the start of this year. The team's leadership has sought to recruit well-known riders and gain entry to the most prestigious cycling events. Israel Premier Tech's results in this year's Tour de France show that these efforts have started to pay off, and the team will likely remain visible at the highest levels of professional cycling in the coming years. But what does this mean for Palestinian advocacy in an age of expanding normalization with the Zionist regime? Despite its name, Israel Premier Tech does not represent the Zionist regime in any official capacity. Adams has maintained that the team is not a project, noting that sports and politics should never mix. But Adams also styles himself as the self-appointed ambassador for the regime of Israel and has taken an aggressive approach to combat the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, BDS, through soft diplomacy. In addition to Israel Premier Tech, Adams was the main force behind the Giro d'Italia arrival in the occupied territories in 2018, an event he described as antidote to BDS. And his work to normalize the Zionist regime through sports extends beyond the world of cycling. He helped bring Lionel Messi and Argentinian football team to the occupied territories in 2019 for a match against Uruguay, and he is supporting the upcoming West Asian Regional Ironman Championship in Tiberias. Members of Israel Premier Tech have tried to distance themselves from the actions of the Zionist regime, saying they just want to race bikes. The fact that most of the team's riders are not Israeli nationals helps in this regard. Out of the 31 riders who race at the World Tour level, only 4 are from the occupied territories, and only one of those competed on the team's 8-person roster in this year's Tour de France. Fundamentally, though, the team's broader modus operandi appears to involve advancing Zionist soft power objectives, even if inadvertently. According to Adams, the riders understand that they are ambassadors for the team's regime. Some of the riders have traveled to the occupied territories, taking part in photo ops to reach millions of followers, and have even ridden in the occupied West Bank and Golan Heights. And contrary to its own projected image, Israel Premier Tech often appears to be treated as an official Israeli body. At the beginning of this year's Tour de France, the team received the security detail provided for Israeli delegations, and the Zionist media outlets claimed team victories as a first for Jewish regime, with additional congratulations from the Israeli regime tourism minister. In this way, Israel Premier Tech becomes part of the normalization bandwagon as an unofficial ambassador for the fake regime of Israel. While BDS makes provisions for countering this kind of cultural normalization, it is important to highlight that unofficial ambassadorship for the Zionist regime in the world of professional sports is a new and worrying phenomenon. When we think of sports washing, what often comes to mind are high-profile sporting events held in occupied territories. The opening days of the 2018 Giro d'Italia, for example, or official Israeli teams participating in international competitions. The Premier Tech falls into neither of these categories. Instead, the team builds on the existing name recognition and cultural capital of its roster to reach the millions of cycling fans Adams calls the silent majority. Those who lack strong political opinions about the fabricated regime of Israel, and for whom the Premier Tech offers a new and exciting image of the apartheid regime. This is unsurprising, given that many cycling fans are either unaware or simply see no need to protest other cycling teams who are sponsored by authoritarian regimes or petrochemical corporations. As football stars, basketball players, and other athletes speak up for Palestinians, professional cycling presents a more promising avenue for the Zionist sports washing. This does not mean that advocates of Palestinian rights should give up on the cycling world. They should push back against Israel Premier Tech's attempts to distance itself from the Zionist regime and refuse the distinction between sports and politics. As Palestinian and allied organizations have argued, Israel Premier Tech is the Zionist regime in professional cycling and should be treated as such. Following the example of French BDS chapters, Palestine advocates should protest the team's presence at all public events and expose the double standards that prevent certain authoritarian governments from sponsoring teams but not others. The BDS movement should likewise push the team's most famous athletes, particularly Froome, whom Adams explicitly hired to help transform the Zionist regime's international image, to account for their ambassadorship on behalf of the Zionist regime and protest Premier Tech's involvement in the project as a primary funder. Saudi Arabian, Qatari, and other Arab sports washing ventures continue to grab headlines. BDS advocates should highlight Israel Premier Tech as part of this troubling trend, one that aligns with the broader goals of normalization between the Zionist regime and the Arab world. Finally, Palestinians and their allies should not lose sight of the man behind the team. Adams is currently coordinating with the Saudi Arabian sports minister to place a bid for the fabricated regime of Israel to co-host the 2030 World Cup with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the UAE.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
This Friday prayer is a weekly event. The next feature is the continuity of this event, these weekly meetings. Another feature of the Friday prayers is the combination of spirituality and politics. When we look at this collection of features, we come to the conclusion that in the line of the soft power of the Islamic system, the Friday prayer is a very important link, because that which is influential and is a leading factor today is soft power. Hard power, bullets and guns and these sort of things are at a lower level today. What's important is soft power, influencing the hearts, minds and spirits. Of course, our soft power chain is a long, comprehensive chain. The Friday prayer is one of the most important links in this chain. We come to this conclusion when we look at these features.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So, is the Friday prayer in this sublime position in the Islamic Republic or not? It seems to me that we have had some shortcomings. Now, you know that I too am your colleague in this field. We've had shortcomings in this field. We need to strive, all of us should strive, to eliminate these shortcomings. Like I said, a part of this is the responsibility of the Friday prayer leaders themselves, and another part is the responsibility of the officials in charge of the macro management of the leaders of the Friday prayers. We need to pay attention to this. Now, regarding the Friday prayer leaders, I said that a part of it is the responsibility of the Friday prayer leader. Some things are related to the Friday prayer leader's behavior. Some of the factors that must be observed in order for the Friday prayer to find its correct place is dependent on the behavior. Some of the factors that must be observed in order for the Friday prayer to find its correct place in society is dependent on the behavior and lifestyle of the Friday prayer leader. I will talk about two or three of these characteristics in a moment. Some other things are related to the sermons. We're not discussing their method or behavior here. If the content of the sermons is good, it can bring the Friday prayer back to the way it should be. Now, regarding that which is related to the Friday prayer leader's ways, my dear brothers and respected gentlemen, on Fridays, the Friday prayer leader calls on people to practice piety with his words. What I'm saying is that you must invite people to practice piety with your behavior on Saturdays, Sundays, Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
in the limelight.
CEO pay rose 18.2% faster than the U.S. inflation rate of 7.1%, a new analysis finds. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. CEOs, not working people, are causing inflation. Report shows soaring executive pay. Here's more. The AFL-CIO's latest annual analysis of top executive pay was published recently with the following conclusion. CEOs, not working people, are causing inflation. In recent months, corporate bosses and top Federal Reserve officials have pointed to workers' wages as a factor in surging prices, which have pushed overall inflation in the United States to a four-decade high. Runaway CEO pay is a symptom of greedflation, when companies increase prices to boost corporate profits and create windfall payouts for corporate CEOs. But the AFL-CIO's new report attempts to reframe the national inflation discussion, emphasizing that while wage increases won by ordinary workers are drawing outsized attention from policymakers and executives, CEO pay hikes significantly outpaced the wage increases of rank-and-file employees last year. Titled Greedflation, the report shows that in 2021, CEOs of S&P 500 companies received on average $18.3 million in total compensation. The analysis finds CEO pay rose 18.2% faster than the U.S. inflation rate of 7.1%. The new analysis says, in contrast, U.S. workers' wages fell behind inflation. With worker wages rising only 4.7% in 2021, the average S&P 500 company CEO-to-worker pay ratio was 324-1. The highest paid executive among S&P 500 companies last year was Expedia's Peter Kern, who brought in an eye-popping $296 million in total compensation. Other executives at the top of 2021 list were Amazon CEO Andy Jassy, Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger, Apple CEO Tim Cook, and JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon. Runaway CEO pay is a symptom of greedflation when companies increase prices to boost corporate profits and create windfall payouts for corporate CEOs, the new analysis states. During a conference call outlining the report's findings, AFL-CIO Secretary-Treasurer Fred Redmond said that when you look at those numbers and at CEOs trying to blame workers for inflation, it just doesn't add up. In his remarks during an earnings call earlier last year, for instance, Amazon's chief financial officer attributed inflationary pressures felt within the company during the final quarter of 2021 to wage increases and incentives in the operations. But Redmond pointed out that last year Amazon delivered the highest CEO-to-worker pay ratio in the S&P 500 index with a pay ratio of 6,474-1. In a blog post recently, economist Dean Baker similarly argued that soaring executive pay is contributing to inflation, which has eroded modest wage gains that many ordinary workers have seen since late 2020. We transfer tens of billions of dollars upward to CEOs and other top corporate executives through the corrupt corporate governance structure that we have instituted, writes Baker, a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. In this context, it is not surprising that even mediocre CEOs can get paychecks in tens of millions of dollars annually. And it is not just the CEO. If the CEO gets $20 million, the chief financial officer might get $10 to $12 million, and even third-tier executives may get $2 to $3 million. He added, "This is all inflationary." The AFL and CIO's analysis was released as the Federal Reserve gears up to hike interest rates by another 75 basis points at its upcoming policy meeting, a move that economists fear could push the U.S. economy closer to recession. The second consecutive 75/10 percentage point rate hike is expected despite evidence that key drivers of inflation, such as gas prices, are cooling. Wage growth has also slowed substantially in recent months, prompting experts to warn that additional rate increases could slash wages by driving up the unemployment rate, a potential disaster for millions of Americans. Josh Bivens, the director of research at Economic Policy Institute, noted, "Higher unemployment lowers wage growth much more reliably and by larger amounts than it lowers inflation. Currently, wage growth is decelerating. This means there is no genuine need for a recession to put wage growth down to sustainable levels." The AFL-CIO's Redmond echoed that sentiment, declaring that we need to raise wages to help working people cope with rising prices, not make working people poorer by causing a recession.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On the 30th of August last year, the last of the U.S. troops hastily left Kabul International Airport, marking the end of a two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. On its anniversary, the people of Afghanistan are celebrating this occasion. They say being independent and free from any occupation is a great blessing for the nation.
This is a victorious day for Afghans. 1 year ago, the U.S. occupying forces were forced to leave Afghanistan. Of course, they were defeated against the will of our people. We are proud that another invasion failed in our country.
Most Afghan people believe the U.S. invasion brought them nothing but more conflict, poverty, destruction, and suffering. They say today it is Afghans who are in charge of their own country and that they should work to build their homeland.
In the past 20 years, we didn't witness anything except bombardments, destruction, and civilian casualties. People across the country were busy burying their loved ones every day.
We have gathered here to mark Afghanistan's independence from the U.S. occupation. Last year, on this day, the U.S. withdrew from our country. We are happy that the U.S. is no more present here. But unfortunately, our country is reeling from economic problems. I hope the new rules of Afghanistan provide job opportunities and protect the rights of all Afghans.
Participants also called on the U.S. to learn from its past mistakes and stop the ongoing ill policies towards Afghanistan and its people. 1 year on, Afghans are celebrating the U.S. withdrawal from their country. People here say they are happy that the U.S. invasion was ended because they were exhausted by Americans' gross violations. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
England's healthcare service workers, receiving national praise for staying in the job through the grueling days of the pandemic to save lives. An increasing number of them, doctors, nurses, and midwives, have either quit the service or are actively considering to do so.
Profits have risen by 35% in the UK since the pandemic. More money to the rich, but not to those that are sick or for people that care for them.
The most recent culprit, poor pay. Rejecting a 4% pay increase in the face of soaring inflation, they're set to vote for industrial action.
Even with all those budgeting, we are still struggling. And so what would help in the NHS really was to increase our salary like everybody else is getting bonuses. We are not. Why? Why is this? And if you're not going to increase our salary, at least do something about transportation or even the parking. We can't be paying for things like this. It's ridiculous.
There are other reasons, too, for the exodus. A recent survey by union-led With NHS Staff Campaign found stress, burnout, a feeling of abandonment after the pandemic. Some are having to use food banks or sleep inside hospitals. And it doesn't stop there.
There were other abuses of staff which made themselves clear, which also manifested. And actually, a large part of the nursing workforce who want to learn also cite discrimination. And there's a large amount of bullying, harassment, intimidation, discrimination that goes hand in hand with not every environment within the NHS, but within certain environments.
More people leaving the NHS means more work to be done by those who stay while they wait for the tens of thousands of vacancies across the country to be filled. A negative spiral hard to overcome in addition to the cost of living crisis. And then there's the years of underfunding and a wholesale drive to privatization, regardless of which party is in power.
The plan to privatize the NHS is not piecemeal. It's wholesale. I'm afraid Labour and Tory are like this. There isn't a fundamental difference in their attitude. We're already facing a winter bed crisis now. It's August, okay? And it's only going to get worse through the winter. So there is an under-provision in order to force people who can't get adequate care from the NHS into the private sector.
Created after World War II by a Labour government, the NHS is a publicly funded healthcare system, free at the point of need. Decades later, though, it's facing acute staff shortages, underfunding, and rapid privatization, which means that the crown jewel of Britain's public healthcare provision may soon be no more. Saeed Purizap, London.
Pakistan is racing against time to prevent further loss of life and accelerate aid deliveries to those affected by relentless monsoon rains and devastating flooding, which have led to a staggering number of casualties and caused billions of dollars in damage. Fears of flooding around the riverbanks prompted thousands from north to south to flee their homes. With some living on highways with their livestock, miles away from their flooded villages and towns, many still are not ready to leave their houses underwater.
Our houses have been washed away with floods, with everything we had. We have nothing to lose now. We are living in miserable conditions and waiting for help from the government.
Millions of Pakistanis affected by the worst flooding in a decade are in desperate need of aid. Thousands are living in temporary shelters, as the authorities say they have been overwhelmed by the scale of the disaster.
We evacuated people from low-lying areas. Almost around 50,000 people were evacuated within a span of 10 hours. The relief side is ongoing. The district administration is providing meals, medicines, lodging, and all other facilities.
Press TV's crew visited a flood-hit region on the bank of River Kabul in Nowshera district of one of the worst-hit provinces of Pakistan, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Powerful flash floods caused the Kabul River to swell, sweeping away bridges overnight, cutting off the local population from road access. However, rescue workers say that they have managed to save the lives of thousands of residents thanks to early evacuations.
We remain successful in preventing life losses as our rescue teams make it possible to evacuate people before the flood water hits the nearby population on the bank of River Kabul. Now we are trying to deliver food via boats to the people who are still stranded in flood water.
Relief camps have been established by the Pakistani government in various parts of the country for flood victims. However, many remote regions are still waiting for rescue teams.
The remains of the flood show the intensity of the disaster.